in case you couldn't tell, this is an Alan Smithy podcast. My name's Matt, and I write for cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And I'm Andrew, and I write for thestopbutton.com. And today is,
well, it's very special. We're not doing a good movie, bad movie. We're doing a double feature of Lost Carpenter, his 1970 Academy Award-winning short film, Resurrection of Bronco Billy, and his 1979 three-hour made-for-TV movie, Elvis, starring Kurt Russell. And it was the first time that they worked together in 1979. And you just rewatched Big Trouble in Little China on HD, didn't you?
I didn't get around to watching it. I was going to watch it some night over the weekend, and I was
too... Oh,
that's
good. That's good, because, yeah, it might have colored your impression of Russell's Elvis. Might have made you a little bit more aware that he was Kurt Russell, though. it was a good, you know, it's a good impression and everything. It's just not...
Well, the whole movie is kind of like that. And so I thought that that was... I thought he was really appropriate for it.
Yeah.
The way he handled it.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize... okay, so I guess we're starting with Elvis, but let's talk for just a second about how the fact it's not available. It never came out on video in the U.S. It came out... the copy we watched is the UK video release that came out at some point in the 80s, I think, and used to go for hundreds of dollars on eBay when they were still around.
It's got a great super cheesy video logo production, you know,
it does.
Releasing company at the end if you see this release.
Yeah. And then there's the awkward PAL speed up. Because some of the interior shots appear to have been shot on video. And I hope I'm not slandering Carpenter, because I'm sure that if I'm wrong, he would take offense to that. But some of the interiors were, the speed up was really bad, and then other ones it wasn't even noticeable. But I thought it wasn't released because it used real Elvis music.
Well, the peculiar thing is that it uses Elvis songs, but they're sung by someone other than Elvis and then dubbed over Kurt Russell's performance. So they're their own recordings, which I would think would make it easier for the music rights to be cleared.
But apparently not. Because I can't understand how... I mean, just, you know, in 1983, why they wouldn't have put this out on tape.
It was actually a huge ratings hit. It did very well.
And it changed the public perception of Kurt Russell, who until this point had been the Disney kid through the 70s. And then, of course, kicked off sort of his early career with Carpenter.
Mm-hmm. It's weird. He doesn't really sell the dramatic scenes so well. Like, the latter half of the movie about his relationship with Priscilla kind of lacks something, even though he's acting with Susan Hubley, who I guess married him after this. She's the girl in Chock Full of Nuts in Escape from New York, who he lights cigarettes with and then almost kisses, and the crazies drag her into the floor. And they were married when they filmed that, but here they're not married and they're acting together. And I don't know, they don't really have a chemistry, and the movie kind of hurts for that later. But when Russell's just kind of being Elvis, like in a casual situation or in the concert scenes or something, he's got like nice little moments that aren't dramatic, but they're nice little character moments that feel like they would be authentic to the real Elvis.
Yeah, the second half, or if it even is a whole half of it, because it's very front-heavy in that sort of Elvis coming up from being this...
poverty-stricken hillbilly.
Well, I was also going to talk about, you know, his odd relationship with his dead twin brother, who apparently died it.
Yeah, and, who knew? Who knew about that?
And so at that point, I don't know what point I don't think I actually checked until after, because the impression, whoever does the Elvis singing, it sounds a lot like him, to the point that I couldn't tell it wasn't. And in some scenes I'm like, I thought that was what was kind of amazing about it, just because Carpenter, you started as an editor of stuff, like Bronco Billy, he edited that, which we'll talk about in a bit. But I thought that he had taken those audio tracks of Elvis and sort of made them fit the scenes, which I, you know, during rehearsals was just an amazing idea. But then I found out that he hadn't. And so I was wondering why it hasn't been released, because my impression of it was this was the family sanctioned Elvis movie that Priscilla had sort of, you know, let them do this. And,
Dick Clark was one of the producers on it as well.
Yeah, it was Dick Clark Productions, and he did some other music movies too. He did Beatles one.
So it's extremely wholesome and a clean picture of Elvis.
And so I think in the second half, there's really the problem with that because, okay, so they don't make it clear for someone who doesn't know, and maybe I knew this at one point in my life and forgot it because it wasn't very important. It isn't clear when he meets Priscilla that she's 14 years old. They're just at a party. You know, everybody looks like they're at a beach party in a beach party movie, and everybody's 22 or 28 playing 22. And then, especially in the second half, when he starts to sort of kind of fall apart and they can't make it clear what's going on in his life because it would paint a
sort of... Yeah, they don't depict any prescription drug abuse or overeating whatsoever.
And so it comes off as being sort of a intense negative reaction to his mother's death.
And yeah, like, well, sort of prolonged. And by the way, they did show Priscilla being dropped off at high school, but I'd forgotten that she was 14 at the time. I just thought, oh, she's 17 or something. But
I think at that point I might have paused it and looked it up, because when he asked the father if he can take care of her.
Yeah.
I mean, that just is like, and the movie doesn't make it clear, but that's not actually what happened. Like, the whole her whole family moved there, and the movies skips over it because in the second half, it's really loose about how much the passage of time. And one moment, you're going from Elvis talking to her father saying, she can live here at Graceland. You know, my dad will make sure I don't do anything inappropriate.
Yeah.
And then it cuts to her being there. And it's not clear. And that's not that wholesome, though. I don't know.
Well, it's not. But, you know, like you're saying, he, you know, instead of showing what actually happens, because this was made 2 years after Elvis died in 77. And the movie begins as a flashback from and then ends on his 68, I think, comeback special when he played in Las Vegas, and he's not like, what am I trying to say? I think I lost my train of thought.
Well, it's an interesting framing, especially because it doesn't have the, you know, Elvis died in 1977 sort of title card at the end, which I was kind of expecting. And then for a TV movie, it's really jarring when it has those TV movie credits at the end with, you know, some clips from the interviews.
Just one still frame.
And that just doesn't work for it, because they... You know, Carpenter really pulls it off. Even with... There is some other stuff that sort of hints at the lunacy of it is like when Kennedy dies and
he's got
that, you know, and I'm thinking about it and it's like, that guy wants to shoot Elvis. And it's like, wait, no, that's not what Jack Ruby did. Or what's his face did. And it's just like,
I remember what I was going to say. The fact that it all ends in 68 and it only goes that far and it doesn't tell you what happens afterwards is, I mean, a cop out. And because in the last act of the movie, Elvis isn't going through it. He divorced Priscilla in like 72, I think.
Yeah.
So that was kind of imminent and that's what he was going through, but they also had to unspokenly acknowledge that he was going to die. And so they had him say like, well, you know, I don't really, you know, I'll probably burn out before 40. He was like 42, I think. And I'll, you know, there's just something, you know, it's like generic kind of, why aren't I happy? I have all my riches and fame.
Right.
Why aren't I happy? And the viewer can kind of fill in like, oh, maybe it's because he loved his mother so much. Cause his mom dominates the first half of, the whole 3 hours. Shelley Winters plays his mom.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I don't think, trying to remember what I read on Wikipedia, but I think their marital problems started with his continued LA performance or Las Vegas performances. Mm-hmm. And so like the shot of her doing karate. Do you remember that?
That was bizarre.
No, that's a reference. She ran off with her karate instructor. But it was in the 70s. So it was like a throw in for people who knew what had happened to see it. And that was, I think, when I was like, wait a minute, maybe the family didn't okay this. Because I think they were together at that point. Because wasn't she at the beginning at the concert?
Yeah.
Yeah. So why would she have been at the beginning at the concert when at the end it's like, you know, it's implied that they've broken up? So there's a lot of problems with that. And I mean, the scripts from he wrote TV shows, like episodes. Mm-hmm. And so.
Yeah. The writer and producer of this.
And I think that Carpenter, did he really like Elvis? Does he really like Elvis? Is that.
Yeah, he does.
Some
really
of the
like
mythology it. Of it. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was basically, you know, it was work for hire because he was just working around the clock in 1979.
Yeah.
But he did it, and I don't know if he wanted to work with Kurt Russell or whatever, or how much of a hand he had in casting him.
But it worked out after that. So yeah, well, I think
I've always skipped over the chapter in my John Carpenter interviews book on Elvis because I didn't want to know anything.
And now. You can go back and look at it. Yeah. I used to. Yeah.
The movie kind of, you know, makes it about the women in Elvis's life from his mama to the girl he doesn't end up marrying to Zilla.
And the fact that there's no closure scene with the girl he doesn't end up marrying, I found odd. In that sort of very TV movie kind of way, like she was only going to be in the first night and not in the second night.
Well, actually, apparently it was all one night.
Oh, was it?
It was a 3-hour spectacular.
But Shelley Winters is, let's see, what does she want him to do? She wants him to quit and open up a hamburger joint. Or something at one point. And it's just incredibly awkward. And
the movie starts off a little awkward. It starts off with this kick-ass, like, incidental thing based on fact of Elvis shooting a TV. And then when they flash back to his childhood, it gets real awkward real fast because of Shelley Winters and the kids, including young Elvis, aren't that good.
Yeah.
So it's really, you know, it's a little off-putting. And, like, for some weird dreamlike reason, young Elvis is wearing the exact same clothes as the bully who's attacking him.
Well, the other thing about that scene was,
maybe it's a reference to this twin that the mama makes a big deal about.
That's probably true, right? That there was this twin and he... I thought that was going to be like his psychosis through the whole movie that he was, and they do bring it up that, you know, he,
they make like one callback to it an hour later.
That was kind of cool. Like that. It was weird. I mean,
yeah.
Watching this and not thinking about Bubba Hotep was impossible for me because I think that, you know, Bubba Hotep being the sort of, you know, this subtly brilliant way of dealing with the whole Elvis is still alive thing that, you know, the sequel, if they ever make it, will probably ruin. But, you know, it's in this one, he's, anytime they get in high school, he sort of has a character, I guess, but he's bullied. And that's, it's awkward.
It's Kurt Russell playing him in high school too.
Yeah. So.
I kept thinking how, like, even the teenager scenes in Christine are kind of better than in Elvis.
Well, in...
But so, you know, I guess it's like any biographical movie, though, where people are yelling, like, hey, Elvis, or hey, Jesus, or hey, Hitler, and they're not yet famous. So there's kind of that disassociation.
There's that, but there's also the whole, like... The movie skips over Elvis having that early gospel career too, which I kind of know about. Not really at all, only that he did a bunch of gospel music.
Yep. They kind of regulate that influence in his life to one scene where the child Elvis is singing on a porch with a black family.
Yeah. And they don't mention any of the racial stuff.
Right. Obviously. His first record. They have his first record producer acknowledge that he's been looking for a white boy who could sing like a black guy.
But
that's the most you hear of it.
And Charles Cyphers was good in that little role. Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As, what's that guy's name? Sam Phillips.
But the rest of the cast. Oh, did you notice Joe Mantegna's haircut? That was awesome. But, there's very little introduction to any of his friends throughout the movie, except for Red, who's like this 42-year-old guy playing the character in high school, which was really awkward. It's a TV movie biopic, no matter what, you know, no matter what, that's what it is. No matter how good Kurt Russell is during some of the performance, during some of the onstage stuff. It's still just a TV movie biopic, and finding Carpenter-esque moments in it are...
yeah, it's right.
There's some, I would say, some composition.
And then Pat Hingle explodes into the thing, right?
Pat Hingle...
His big stomach opens up. I liked how he had the credit of special guest star.
Yeah, of course.
Sometimes you see that credit in movies, and it's like, hey, idiots, you can't have a special guest star in your movie. But
you can't really have it in a TV show, even in a TV movie. I think they did that in a miniseries. Like Rich Man Poor Man had a special guest star, which kind of made more sense because there were 9 episodes of it or whatever. But yeah, like if you have a 2-hour event, you can't have a special guest star, so that's why I thought they probably cut it up for re-airings.
Well, Pat Hingle as Colonel Tom Parker just disappears, and I was sort of, I guess this movie, you keep expecting some things to develop, and then the most boring thing develops, like Red West. Colonel Parker would have made a, you know, boilerplate villain for the Elvis life story because he was taking 50% of his earnings by, you know, 70, maybe by the late 60s, I think, around the time of that.
He wasn't even in that section. He disappeared.
He just disappears, yeah. And there's one, and like at some point Elvis says, like, oh, you know, the Colonel wouldn't want me doing that. And it's maybe like the karate shots, it's a reference to Those Who Know, that Colonel Parker was really calling the shots for him by that point.
Wasn't there, oh, and he's freaking out about how they change his music. The Priscilla tells him to call the Colonel and the Colonel will know what to do. And I'm like, oh, the Colonel's coming back. And no, he's not. And it's hard to believe Well, I'm sure they did it to keep it as genial as possible to all parties involved.
Basically.
So it's, let's see. I think we're probably zoning out on a huge portion of the movie.
Well, yeah, there are a lot of music scenes
There are a
in the
lot of
movie.
music scenes.
Yeah, like they definitely got a ton of songs. And I remember Carpenter used to say or said in some interview that he would like to do a musical someday. And this is probably as close as he ever got or ever will get. And the way he shoots the concerts is pretty straightforward. But then in a couple of them, there's like nice moments within the scene, like when Elvis kisses that girl on the cheek from the crowd.
Yeah.
And that's pretty good. I mean, the music scenes are all adequate, and Kurt Russell does the Elvis dance steps all right. So those, they're pretty entertaining, but I guess towards the end they were starting to feel like filler.
Oh, the last one, he does three songs, right? I was just waiting for
Oh,
the
right,
movie to
because
end.
yeah,
Yeah, and
that's
then
right. It's the very end of the movie. It's his comeback special.
is it's comeback special and they do three songs and it's just kind of like, okay,
Yeah.
this is kind of getting there, 'cause it's it's like we could talk about all the things that they start to talk about and then ignore, like
Right.
the relationship with the father, which is, at time it's hardly ever explained or it's hardly ever developed, except for there's like some scene where the father tells Elvis that Elvis can do whatever he wants and he'll be proud of him no matter what, and you're just like, that's so the father didn't sue them. But then he's hardly in it and they never say why he's hardly part of
Yeah.
this family structure.
Right. Well, it's like when the real people in Elvis's life started to become problems, that's when they disappear in this Elvis movie. They just vanish into space. Like the father, who he doesn't have a good relationship with, but then, yeah, he says something that's just enough closure that he can disappear now. And it's not even like they keep introducing new characters. It's just they have to make room for Priscilla, basically. That's why the first half is better when you got kind of a myriad of
Yeah.
characters. Because Carpenter casts so well, and he casts good people in small roles, like the lady secretary of
Yeah.
Charles Cipher's.
She was great.
She just has a tiny part. She's just his assistant, but she's memorable.
And then the problem with Priscilla is it's they're dealing with so much. They're dealing with the whole army thing, the 2 years in the army that they fast forward through. And so, well, I mean, and then Priscilla's there, and then it's not even like clear that she's the daughter of anyone in the army when she's introduced.
You have to pick it up when you see the colonel's uniform on her dad when Elvis is on with him on the
Yeah,
phone.
and then it's never, the we're not going to make these movies anymore scene is, Elvis has got the weight of the world on his shoulders, man. Not only did his mom die 5 years earlier, they're not realizing that he's this mega star, but the movie has to present it in such a way to make him seem like the good guy in the scene. And it's kind of unbelievable. The other thing about that scene is, they goof off on the set of the movie and it's kind of unbelievable the director would get mad about it. I'm like, come on. It's an Elvis movie. I'm sure they work really hard on shooting those and
Yeah, they touch on the army career, they touch on the movie career, but neither you're not really sure what either thing's really meant to him. Like he's saying, I don't even know why this is in real life. He's saying he's got to go off and do service.
yeah.
Why? He's like, what if you get killed? And he's like, oh, it's peacetime. And it's like, all right, why are you going?
I assumed he got drafted into early Vietnam days, like always. And then, yeah, no, I had no idea why he joined up. Okay, I mean, I wasn't even interested enough to look it up, but
Yeah, me. But yeah, lots of unfinished stuff. Yeah, the rise to fame story is better. I was thinking about like the screenwriters of Ed Wood say, you know, their philosophy is that you begin and end on the most interesting period in the person's life.
Yeah.
That's why Ed Wood ends with the premiere, and then they tell you with titles what happened to everybody. Yeah, they couldn't. I guess they couldn't. You know, their hands were tied with this, but you know, how much were they? Why isn't this movie released? Goes back to that question.
And
You know what's not good? The music, which wasn't done by Carpenter. The TV movie
yeah.
music is pretty bad when it's not Elvis music.
Yeah, it's and even the Elvis music at times it's peculiar because at times he's singing it, but at other times it's the incidental music. And I think that my problem with the Rise to Fame part was is it doesn't have any I couldn't tell when he was famous. Like, 'cause after the Grand Ole Opry thing, you know, when he gets, you know, he storms out, I'm like, okay. So that means he's not famous yet. But no, 'cause the next scene is he's touring and he's famous and what's her face from Flash Gordon's gonna break up with him now, which I found to be, you know, that whole thing was problematic 'cause if he's really famous and he was making 2,000 a week or whatever, you'd think he could have, I don't know, gotten married. And I wasn't sure if she was a composite character or if she was supposed to be, if that's a real person. Don't even remember the character's name anymore.
Probably a composite.
So, and then what else? They never develop or they never conclude the whole thing about him being bullied and feeling like he needs to prove himself to men or whatever. Like when he was chasing the guy down in the car. But that was the last time that was mentioned.
It would have been. I was hoping since Carpenter is a film buff that they might make some reference to him being directed by Don Siegel in Flaming Star, but it never came. That's
No.
his one serious role, or his most serious, I would say.
And even with, you know, they have the New York Times gave him a good review in King Creole, it doesn't go anywhere. Like the whole movie thing is just kind of, they don't have room for it.
He goes from you know, caring about his movie career to a few scenes later without any mention. He's saying, you know, forget about these dumb movies.
And the thing is, you know, Elvis would have been able to bankroll his own movies, right? Like,
Yeah, he could have.
so, okay. But I guess that would have been too Mel Gibson-y of a
Well, you know,
move.
that was a few decades, it was still a few decades ahead of,
Mel Gibson. Wow. Mel Gibson truly is the.
and Prince, you know.
Did Prince really have to bankroll those? Wasn't Purple Rain a huge hit?
Yeah, it was a huge hit, but he put his own money into it.
Did he? Wow. So where are we on the
Oh,
time?
we got 30. Yeah, Elvis is, gee, you know, it's worth seeing if you're a Carpenter fan, and I guess it's worth seeing if you're an Elvis fan, and that's who it should, you know, appeal
Yeah.
to. It's just
It's
not,
not,
it's
yeah.
not brilliant.
Well, no, it's, yeah.
It's pretty sanitized, and it gets a little boring, but there's a lot of good stuff.
And it's, that's what I was thinking before I started it, was that, you know, I've been looking forward to seeing this movie for 15 years or something, you know, since probably right after I saw Escape from New York, whatever that VHS release they had back in the mid 90s. The widescreen one. And so, you know, I've been looking forward to it for so long, and I was trying to think of the other movies that I'd been looking for, like, what else was there that I'd been looking forward to? And I remembered that Chimes at Midnight, The Wells. But even that, like, it wasn't like I'd been looking forward to it for this long, or Woody Allen's interiors I was probably looking forward to for like 6 months. And that kind of thing. I'm like, wow, is it going to come through? And then maybe from like the first second, I'm like, no, it's really not going to. Because of the rareness, I think that this sort of mythic John Carpenter, Kurt Russell, the lost
movie. Yeah, their first pairing, the lost movie.
And I'm sure, you know, it's probably, what, the best Elvis performance in these, you know, serious biopics. I would still go with Bruce Campbell and Bubba Hotep. But, you know, at a certain point, I forgot that Kurt Russell didn't play Elvis in True Romance type thing. Mm-hmm. I was like, wow, it's perfect imitation. So, yeah.
Yeah, Kurt Russell fans, too. Absolutely worth it. If you're a fan of the subject or the two principals behind this movie.
Or you're a Susan Hubley fan, because I don't think she did much else. But it's probably not worth paying $500 to buy the PAL VHS tape off of eBay now.
Everything comes out eventually, sometimes.
Sometimes.
So we'll, you know, hang tight and see about this one in the future. But it was cool. I'm glad I saw it.
Yeah.
So let's talk about, jump back 9 years in time here to The Resurrection of Bronco Billy.
So
70.
Here's another one that, you know, you'd only read about, I guess. Cause even though there is a website that says they'll send you, right after we did the first episode of the podcast, I found it. And they said they'd send me a copy of The Resurrection of Bronco Billy, and I would just have to send them a check after it got here. And I'm still waiting for it to arrive. But I think it was like the actor's website. And he was sending them out or something. And this one was it was a big deal because it won Best Short Film at the Oscars.
Although Carpenter wasn't the producer, so he didn't go up on stage and accept it. The producer was a guy named John Longenecker,
who may or may not have been a casting agency director. Did you notice that in the credits, that it was casted by the John Longenecker agency? And I was like, so wait, did they come up with the name and he was just a colleague in school, or did they have to say the casting director produced it? Which is kind of interesting because it's very clear that the whole thing is a collaboration between Carpenter, Nick Castle, and the credited director, Bob Rokos, maybe?
Yeah. James Rokos.
James Rokos. And there are some very Carpenter things about it, though.
And some very un-Carpenter things.
Yeah. But the Carpenter things, I don't know if you weren't familiar with, say, his audio commentaries and what he says about stuff. Just like the cursory Carpenter fan might not get some of the references. Or just the approach that... You know, when it's at its most interesting, it's, I would say were the parts when it was shot like a Western, but in the sort of modern day settings, which was really cool at times. And that shot of the guy with the huge skyscrapers, that was cool. And then the bars and the girl, not the girl in the park, but the girl selling him, I think that was an Orange Julius stand. That seemed kind of interesting. And then the kind of geeky film references seemed like, I mean, Carpenter loves Westerns. So that's another connection that he's sort of, what did they say? I mean, I know you can't stand it, but Ghosts of Mars was pretty well reviewed by certain critics. I think you know, like Siskel and Ebert or Ebert and whoever, who kind of were like, why doesn't Carpenter just make a Western, which he has never done, not even for TV.
Yeah, this was the closest he ever got. And I, you know, sort of going into it, knowing that it was about a kid obsessed with Westerns. Do you notice how that's like Tim Burton's Vincent is a kid obsessed with Vincent Price movies, and people make movies about children obsessed with the fantasy world that they are going to inhabit. It's not done in a Walter Mitty kind of fantastical way at all. Like, it's not like he starts seeing people wearing cowboy hats where they're not. It's like you said, it's the camera acts like a Western movie camera as he's going through the city, and, you know, it's kind of foreshadowing Assault on Precinct 13 or Escape from New York, or kind of movies where he makes cities look like Westerns, modern cities. And it's, you know, sometimes it's really, he does some, I guess because he's imitating all kinds of Western movie styles, he does a lot of tracking shots, but tracking shots are definitely something that he's like, he became a master of later on. But there's also a lot of handheld work, and that's very un-Carpenter. And there's even some handheld work with rapid editing, like when he's crossing the street and cars are blaring horns at him. But also a little scene that was pretty cool, but pretty un-Carpenter. Handheld and quickly edited, he's crossing the street and some like normal schlub in a suit sees him coming, and he's feeling very awkward about having to walk past this kid dressed as a cowboy.
Well, and there's that, but it's all that scene also was like the, you know, he was like, I thought he was going to assault the guy, and I was like, wow, where's this going? Because he did the whole standoff thing.
Right, like he's reaching for his pistol. Yeah. It's a little ambiguous, but I figured he was just messing with him.
Yeah, I mean, it's never clear, and I think that it was their student film? Was it their thesis film, do you know? Or was the beginning of Dark Star sort of...
Oh, good question. No, Dark Star came after this, so this is not a thesis film.
So...
Carpenter's.
It reminded me of... I mean, you went to film school. So, but it reminded me of all the, I mean, obviously a lot better made than all the student films that I saw, but it reminded me of something the professor said about how before, you know, they got to make their student films, they had to give him a list of all the symbols that were going to be in the movie. And it's like watching this, you can see all the symbols. Like, he kicks the bike. I'm like, oh, he's kicking the bike because, you know, that's modern. And, you know, he's mad at the... He's lashing out at the modern world right now. And there's some other moments like that. And it's just kind of like... Or the cars that are cattle. And it's just...
Yeah.
I hadn't seen a student film in 9 years. So this was...
And he wake... Did you notice the first shot of the movie is him waking up out of bed one morning, just like 90% of student shorts.
I think there was some other stuff too, but I think where it got the most interesting in terms of the narrative, not so much the way that they shoot it to gradually become more and more like a real Western, even regardless of setting, is cool, but where it was weird is where he's revealed to be, instead of, you know, this cool protagonist, he's this weirdo who can't shut up about how authentic John Wayne movies are. And
yeah, and it comes at the end.
And it's strange because, you know, it's making fun of the protagonist who we've just seen get beaten up, and his watch was stolen from the...
And actually, you know, maintain something of a, you know, a tough attitude, or the illusion of one, or we believe that, you know, he's got this inner strength.
And instead, he's just this guy who's obsessed with movies, and it's,
Yeah, and he's just talking this girl's ear off and on the USC campus.
But and then the old man he goes to see, who, you know, basically did the same thing only without the movies, is, you know, the old man's born 10 years after, was it Jesse James died? Yeah. And so he sort of must have spent his life learning all this stuff. And then the kid just, you know, does the same thing only with movies. And then the end was kind of weird.
The end was kind of student film cliche.
Yeah.
Wish fulfillment as a deus ex machina. And, you know, so too was going to an older guy to listen to illustrious stories of the past or whatever, the past that he's obsessed with. Although it was well edited. Which Carpenter has the sole credit on.
And the music was good, and it was Carpenter.
Yeah, the music is nice. It's acoustic guitar, and it's, I think Carpenter has the sole credit for that also.
At some point, I was like, I think Carpenter did the music. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he did. So, you know, he brings it all together.
Yeah, and again, one of those, you know, I thought it was going to be some profound short film, you know. Not so much.
Just like a good short film.
Yeah, I mean, it was fine, you know. Yeah. It's pretty good. It makes you wonder what Carpenter, because Carpenter must have made a bunch more. And I think they're even on IMDb. They list them, they're unavailable.
Well, I think because they're like Godzilla movies and stuff, like homemade backyard Godzilla movies or something. But yeah, they've been listed on IMDb for the longest time, predating this one.
But I was expecting Carpenter to show up for some reason, because he showed up in. Did you see him in Elvis?
Yeah, I was going to.
Yeah.
I
was watching that. I'm like, oh, I hope I don't forget that he was in this. But he's in the party scene.
They didn't credit him, but no. Yeah, he's there.
And so
I thought I saw Tommy Lee Wallace, but that could have just been any guy from the late 70s or early 80s with long hair and a mustache. No, he didn't cameo in Resurrection. He wasn't big enough to cameo yet. He wasn't big enough yet that it was John Carpenter's The Resurrection.
I just thought it would be, yeah.
It wasn't John Carpenter's Elvis.
No, it wasn't.
It would scare people off.
It was more like Dick Clark Productions' Elvis. I just thought maybe the 3-4 guys who made it would have been somewhere in it, and we would have recognized Carpenter because it was Carpenter. But Nick Castle's photography was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that he did a really good job with the black and white photography. And it reminded me of those composite photos. I don't remember what they're called, where they, you know, burn in the guy, the businessman walking down the escalator full of water type thing. But they're real mixes of 3 photos. They're not Photoshopped. They're burned and dodged in or whatever. At its best, some of the shots were sort of otherworldly. It's this cowboy, but in modern day LA.
I thought when he steps into that little basement bar, that shot of the basement bar is very you know, it's like a cave or something in black and white.
And it's never clear whether or not he got mugged by the guys who gave him the beer. For some reason it felt like he did.
Oh, I didn't think so.
I thought the voices were the same, and they very well could have been. They just looped it in, but
maybe
I don't know.
Some of those crazy titles before this one: "Revenge of the Colossal Beasts" in 1962, "Terror from Space" in 1963, "Gorgo versus Godzilla" in 1969, and "Gorgon the Space Monster" in 1969. Oh, and "Warrior and the Demon" in 1969, and "Sorcerer from Outer Space" in 1969. So that's what he was making directly leading up to Bronco Billy.
And now, So those would have been his first student. The 69 ones would have been his first student films.
Mm-hmm.
And then the 62 and 65 would have been stuff that he did, you know, with a Super 8 in his backyard.
Right.
So, Gorgo versus Godzilla, that sounds good. Too bad. Too bad we can't see it.
There never was an official,
no.
Smog Monster versus Godzilla.
No, Gorgo's the... Oh, no, Gorgo's the British one.
Yeah.
Oh, I forgot about that. I thought I got Gorgo and the turtle confused. Yeah, no, Gorgo versus Godzilla, wow. And I don't know anything about those, do you? Like, are they...
No, probably just like you said, student films and backyard films.
So...
You know, some of these scenes in the movie, like the bar scene, just kind of seem to stop and end. And I guess that's because it's a short film, after all. But, you know, the scenes only go far enough to kind of give you the impression of what they're about. Like, he walks into the bar and he asks for a drink, and he asks for ID, doesn't have it. Some drunk goes, "Here you go, cowboy," and tosses him a beer. And then it cuts before we see him, like, drinking it or anything. And he's just out of there onto the next scene. Or when he goes to the hardware store.
Yeah.
He rests on the counter and there's that old guy, and it looks like they're about to talk, and he's posturing himself like he's in a saloon or something in a Western. And then the scene just ends.
Yeah.
You don't see them talk to each other.
And instead they do a really long scene with the landlady at the beginning, which,
mm-hmm.
yeah, that it's not the strongest of the early scenes.
No, it's just establishing that he's a kook, and his neighbors know it. He's a nut.
Who doesn't pay his rent because he goes to the movies too much.
Yeah. his landlady is awfully understanding of this. She says it like it's, you know, just a minor annoyance. And when are you going to wear some normal clothes? Oh, boy.
And it's never clear why he doesn't get to wear the hat, though.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's like somebody else's hat. Because he has a hat at the beginning, but then he tells the artist girl that he doesn't have his own hat.
Well, he tosses the hat on the rack before he leaves.
Yeah.
A hat would really come in handy walking around a bright California light. Big wide-brimmed cowboy hat.
Because,
you know, it would have been hot enough under the cowboy clothes shooting that thing. At whatever, like, downtown intersection they were at for that sidewalk crossing scene.
So he gets, sees the old man, gets fired, walks around, goes to the bar, gets beat up, tries to meet the Orange Julius girl, and then he has the scene in the park, which is... stylistically different.
Yeah, it's just a long shot of, like, you know, the two of them talking, and that's sort of the most Carpenter like because Carpenter does long takes of two-shot dialogue.
I guess it moved faster than I thought, because I did not think we were ready for the end when it came, because he didn't, the watch wasn't resolved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
which seemed very student filmy to me after I realized.
Totally, yeah.
Because if you don't,
that he gets from his grandfather has to keep it wound. Yeah.
If you don't resolve it, that's very hip or whatever the terminology would have been. But it seems like it's funny how student films, certain things just don't change about them.
Yeah, because they're just beginner's mistakes that everybody makes, I guess.
Or I think it's encouraged to some degree.
Well. Yeah, telling a story, especially, what am I saying, all these schools are full of communists encouraging us to put symbolism in it, into everything, and write up an approved list of symbols.
Making people watch Peter Weir movies until they understand symbolism.
Yeah, but in 1970, this movie's pretty just straight up entertainment, mostly.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's got some nice, it's got some tricky editing than Carpenter does, like not just the fast sequences, but
right.
The old man's telling him about the old West. He intercuts like panning shots of old photos. So Carpenter predates Ken Burns there. I think Ken Burns is just a huge ripoff artist for what Carpenter did, this for sure. Panning over those photos.
That scene with the old man's interesting. I mean, it's, yeah. I remember a friend of mine wishes, I don't know if he still does, but, you know, that theaters would show shorts, like, all day long. And so, like, if you had, like, 20, 30 minutes to kill, you could go into the theater, watch a short, you know, go to your appointment, whatever. And it seems like this would be good for that. What struck me about it was it opens with the Academy Award winner title card.
Yeah. Well, this was shown in some theaters by Universal, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, that's a big difference between now and 40 years ago, I guess. Wow. That Universal would have done that. Wow.
They would do the logical thing and show some, you know, Academy Award winning shorts, even just to promote the Oscars, you know.
But, well, I remember a few years ago, there's this website, a DVD retailer in Australia. I was just on the website and I noticed all these weird shorts, and so I went through and there were like 40 discs, and it was basically every single short you've ever heard of on IMDb and never been able to see, you know, made by whoever, you know, everything you'd ever heard of that, you know, like Sandra Bullock made that short with Matthew McConaughey that was a big deal, and she couldn't shut up about it in every interview in, you know, 1995, but then nobody ever got to see it, right? Because it's a short. And they were all on these discs, and so I, like, linked all of them to the guy who ran Nicheflix, and he's like, yeah, those are all gone. What are you talking about? Those links are all dead. And I'm like, well, I didn't make them up, because, you know, I couldn't have made up all the links. So apparently in the span of time that it took somebody to read their email, Warner had canceled, you know, 40 releases of these things. And so is it a big deal for a student film to win Best Short? Or is it, do they do that a lot? I don't know.
Well, I don't know. I would imagine it was a big deal then.
Because, I mean, you know, Spielberg didn't even win for Amblin. Right. I mean, I don't even know if he was nominated for it. Which I have somewhere and have never been able to get up enough interest to watch for some reason. Even though I think it opens on a shot of the moon, which is...
I think we were talking about doing like an all...
Oh, yeah, we're going to do the all shorts of... shorts. Yeah.
Oh, but there weren't... Yeah. We couldn't think of enough because there aren't that many.
Yeah. Well, or they're not available. There is... speaking of shorts, I do have some really weird 20 or 30 minute sci-fi short that was like made in Ohio, but it was shown theatrically and it was like made with miniatures, and I got to find it. I mean, I have it, but I think we ought to check that out because it's like, you know, some Ohio auteur of sci-fi movies with miniatures.
Sweet.
Made in his backyard. But, This was an interesting pairing, just that neither of them really delivered.
and you wouldn't know that they were Carpenter if somebody hadn't told you.
Yeah, that's the thing about Elvis, that there's like one shot where I'm like, hey, it's Susan Hoobley standing by the door, kind of like how Jamie Lee Curtis does in Halloween, sort of. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, yeah, it's... That was kind of his last work for hire until...
Christine, I think.
No, Christine, I wouldn't call that work for hire because he got to write the screenplay.
Oh, yeah.
I would actually say that through the 80s, Carpenter...
The Alive trilogy? No, he got to. I guess for hire, it might have been body bags.
Body? So no, it was memoirs. Memoirs was right before that. Yeah,
and memoirs is a major shark jumping moment.
Yeah. So next week we'll have to return to a good and bad.
Yes, we will. We will. And
do you have recommendations?
Well, for bad, we've decided on the Kurt Russell, Sylvester Stallone, Jack Palance classic, Tango and Cash, 1989. And for a good movie, did you look at any of the ones I was thinking about?
I did, but let me get out. I think I'd just seen one of them.
Well, we could do that one.
No, I mean, not recently enough that I could have done it. Or that it wasn't good or something. Oh, yeah, Riding the Whirlwind.
Oh, yeah. That's not very good? Shoot.
No, it's really cool looking, but it's not... No.
Did you ever see The Shooting from 67?
Oh, wait. Maybe that was the one. Yeah, which is the one with Warren Oates?
That's The Shooting.
Okay, then I don't think I've seen all Ride in the Whirlwind.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, Ride in the Whirlwind is a 65, also directed by Monty Hellman, also starring a young Jack Nicholson, but it's not a existentialist waiting for Godot Western. It's, I think it's something a little more rip-roaring. So,
do you want to do that or California Split? Because California Split, I've been wanting to see it since, you know, whenever I heard about it, just because. I don't know. What do you think?
All right. Yeah, we can do California Split.
Okay.
74, Robert Altman, buddy comedy, George Segal, and Elliot Gould. So, Tango and Cash and California Split.
They're both buddy picks. Hey.
Yeah, they're both buddy picks. And the connection between Elvis and Bronco Billy is, of course, cowboys. Like the ones Elvis played in Hollywood, which he may or may not have felt good about doing. We can't tell in the movie.
The Nick Adams cameos, interesting. To say
anyways. So, yes, join us next time. Check out our WordPress, alansmithypodcast.wordpress.com for all the info and updates. Drop us a line there, too, if you have any thoughts, comments, suggestions. This has been an Alan Smithy podcast. I'm Matt, and we'll see you next week.
And I'm Andrew. Thanks for listening.